Okay, I think we can start. Boker Tov, everybody, or good afternoon for those in Israel. Okay, nice to have you. Okay, we're continuing Perkei Avot. We're in the middle of the fourth parak, chapter four. We just sort of very quickly ran through Mishnah Tet last week, so I'll pick up on a couple points. That's 4-9. Kol Mekayim Et HaTorah Me'oni. Sofo Lekayim Me'Yoshua. Whoever fulfills the Torah when they're poor will fulfill it when they're wealthy, and whoever nullifies is mevatel Torah, doesn't fulfill the Torah when they're wealthy, will end up nullifying the Torah when they're poor. So we very briefly last week discussed how the Gemara says basically there are no excuses, that everybody, rich, poor, everybody has to learn Torah. And that's how the Rambam begins, actually, Hilchot Talmud Torah, that everybody has to learn. Everybody's in a different circumstance. And of course, different people have to learn different amounts, depends what you do. Somebody, there could be good reasons for not learning. Somebody who's involved in communal activities or all kinds of things, all kinds of reasons. But the idea that everybody has to learn a minimal amount, we're not going to give a whole talk now on what's the minimum amount that a person has to learn, but the Gemara has a whole discussion. One opinion that you say Kriyat Shema in the morning and the evening, that's I don't know if that's enough, but that fulfills the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. But that's not, first of all, it's not 100% sure this Mishnah is talking about learning. It could be talking, kol ha-mekayem. Mekayem et ha-Torah is not learning. It's that would be called halomed et ha-Torah. Mekayem et ha-Torah means those who fulfill the Torah. It means an observant Jew. Learning is just one part, perhaps even a small part of that person's fulfillment of the Torah. So it's not learning. The commentaries, many of them do focus it on learning, but that's not for sure the only interpretation, or perhaps not even the primary interpretation of the Mishnah. But I just want to discuss the it's obvious problem. It's all over the place, but the Tiferet Yisrael raises it like black and white right on the Mishnah. He says, the Mishnah is not true. Just look around the world. And in other words, we see there are people who are poor who keep the Torah. They never become wealthy. And there are people who are wealthy who are totally disdain the Torah and they don't become poor. So what in the world is the Mishnah talking about? It just isn't true. So in other words, as the Vilna Gaon, apparently as he writes, the fight between when the Shabbos start this evening, the Shabbos start at sunset or Rabbeinu Tam, which is the view of most of the medieval authorities, said it starts much later, like 55 minutes later. We won't go into the calculation now. So the Vilna Gaon says, Hachush Machish, you just look outside. 50 minutes later, it's pitch black. How can Rabbeinu Tam say that 50 minutes after sunset, it's still daylight? Just look with your own eyes and you just see it isn't true. So that's basically the comment that the Tiferet Yisrael makes here. It just isn't true. What do you mean? There's no relationship between people observing the Torah and how wealthy and poor they are. And of course, this is part of the broader question of Tzaddik V'Ra-Lo, why did the righteous have to suffer and the wicked have to prosper? That's a question that bothered Moshe Rabbeinu already. The Gemara says when the Torah doesn't say so explicitly, but the Gemara interprets that when Moshe Rabbeinu said, Harenina et Rachecha, right after the sin of the golden calf. So Moshe prayed, ask God, show me your ways. And God said, you can't know me. So the Gemara interprets that to mean, why do the righteous have to suffer and the poor and the wicked often will prosper? That's how the Talmud interprets or adds on to that question. And God, of course, says you can't understand it. But then he revealed his 13 attributes. This is an old question. But just to point out a couple points, and just say what the Tiferet Yisrael says. The Tiferet Yisrael, first of all, says, it's the point is fascinating. First, it says, first of all, it's like a funny comment. It's almost like, I don't know what he was doing. He says, no, so the Mishnah's not true. Big deal. It's not true what it says in the Torah. The Torah gives us rewards if we keep the mitzvah. Vayah im shamo, if you keep the mitzvah, God will reward you. That's all over the place. And if you don't, you won't. It's not true. It's not true the way we view the world. So if the Torah makes promises and we see them not coming true, no, don't ask a question on the Mishnah. So the rabbis following in the ways of the Torah can also make statement that don't seem to be true. It's a fun, funny. It's like, it's weird. Like for, if you tell this answer to somebody who doesn't have an appreciation of Yiddishkeit, they'll say, this is ridiculous. Like what kind of a religion is this? But obviously we're talking here about, there's a certain understanding that the Torah is never meant to be literal. And we don't really know what rewards are. We don't really know what people are like, but on the surface, it's very, you know, this is obviously a serious problem. We don't see the relationship between reward and your actions. So that's just, and then he says, well, maybe the person did it's shaloli shma. So this is a very strange answer also. In other words, the reason the poor person who is devoted to Torah doesn't become wealthy, perhaps, is because he did the mitzvah not for the right reasons. Maybe he did the mitzvah so he could become wealthy. So if you do something shaloli shma, it's going to take away the reward. So that's a fascinating comment. It's a fascinating idea. We know there's a major debate. I think we discussed this a little last year, that the Talmud says in about five different places that la'olam yasok adam b'torah mitzvah shelo lishma, forever, la'olam, always. A person should always do mitzvot, even for the wrong reason, for honor, for what his neighbors are going to say, for money, to study for a test, whatever reason, not because it's a mitzvah of God, but he has ulterior motives for doing it. Lo'olam yasok adam, that's okay. Shem yitok shelo lishma balishma, because doing it something for the wrong reason eventually will come to the right reason. I meant Rav Chaim of Volozhin has such an insightful comment, la'olam, that opening word, la'olam yasok adam, forever a person should involve himself in term mitzvah shelo lishma. So he says no person, no human being can ever reach the state where he's doing something for pure motivation. That's what it means to be a human being. So our idea is to move on the graph. La'olam, it will always be, we always have personal motives. We always have agendas. There's nothing wrong. That's what it means to be a human being. We want to have less of that and more doing it of a mitzvah. And that's, and Thomas says, fine, that's normal. That's wonderful. So nonetheless, so why is he saying here, shelo lishma takes place? So it's interesting. It could be, yeah, it's fine. You should do mitzvah, but maybe the reward is less. I don't know. I just find that comment of the Tiferet Yisrael, that the one of the ways he explains the problem, why we don't see the connection between reward and observance, is maybe the observance is done shelo lishma. In other words, even though it, shelo lishma counts, maybe not in the same level. I don't know. I find this comment a little bit difficult, but kind of interesting. There is, of course, the other side, that the Talmud in a few places, not the Talmud. The Talmud itself, as far as I know, never asked this question. Tosfot. In the Middle Ages, the Tosafists asked this question every time the Talmud, like in five different places, Psachim, Brachot, a whole bunch of places, makes the statement that you should do mitzvot, even not for ulterior motives, so to speak. That's okay. That's great. Shemitok shelo lishma balishma. So Tosfot always asks, yeah, but the Gemara says that whoever does mitzvot shelo lishma, it's better had he not been born. What are you talking about? It's better than remember. We have a blatant contradiction that we discussed. So you have a blatant contradiction. The Talmud is not that. One of the revolutions, I would say, of the Tosafists. Tosafists, 12th to 14th century, northern France, mainly Germany. You know, for the descendants and students of Rashi, the Ashkenazic tradition, what the Tosafists who revolutionized the study of Talmud, their big innovation was that the Talmud should be seen as a consistent work. In other words, that all views in the Talmud, unless there are times you can't reconcile them, but when the Talmud says something A here and B there, A is talking about one case and B is talking about another case. That was not necessarily the approach before Tosfot. The two Talmuds disagree. Talmud is 500 years of 2,000 rabbis. So what's the big deal? One rabbi says one thing and one rabbi says another thing. They disagree. Tosfot like to harmonize everything. Tosfot always like to harmonize. That's one of their major innovations. So here too, they want to harmonize. On the one hand, it says you should do mitzvot shelo lishma. On the other hand, it says it would be better had you not been born. So the way Tosfot harmonizes these is that he says it's talking about there's different types of shelo lishma. There's shelo lishma, you know, I'm motivated for honor. I'm motivated to look good to my neighbors, the pressure, all kinds of that. That's fine. But sometimes you're motivated for spite or like you want to show your rabbi's an idiot. So you want to, you know, the rabbi's giving a shiur on something. So you're going to study up. You're going to find information that you know the rabbi's not going to know the answer. And then you're going to ask him the question in public. So he'll be a little embarrassed to make the rabbi look embarrassed. So that's lekanter, to sort of to go against person. That's shelo lishma, is much, much worse. Anyways, so, but I find that's just a fascinating comment of shelo lishma. Now, the truth of the matter is, I don't know that the whole issue is a problem. I don't know that the Mishnah is promising a reward. I might want to interpret the Mishnah that kolam akayim et Torah mayoni, so falam kayim osher. It's not a reward. In other words, it means a person who fulfills the Torah when he's poor will also fulfill it when he's wealthy. In other words, if you're committed to Torah, you're committed to Torah under all circumstances. Oh, yes. It's not saying God will reward you. He's saying the type of person who is truly Torah observant is Torah observant wherever they are, whatever material position. So that's not the way the Eretz Yisrael is understanding the Mishnah. But I think, I don't know if the Mishnah is promising a reward. I mean, his question is a question. The problem, we don't see the connection. That question stands. I'm not answering that question. All I'm saying is that the Mishnah may not be talking about that at all. The Mishnah just might be saying that one who fulfills Torah, we know that if you're committed to something, you do it under any and all circumstances. It doesn't matter. So the true trick, if somebody's truly observant Torah, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this exactly, but like, what do they do on vacation in Florida, you know, when no one's watching? That's how you see what the true, maybe that wasn't so nice, but the idea that when a person's in private and nobody knows, do they have that same commitment to Torah or not? Although Rav Soloveitchik once made a comment, what do you say about his grandfather? His grandfather, he says, davened the exact same in private and public, and the same amount of time, etc. He says some rabbis often daven much, I think we all know in the pandemic, I'm sure a lot of us, our davening was much quicker. A lot of times in private is quicker. Although I must say sometimes actually I davened a lot slower in private. And one of the silver linings really is it, especially Friday night, Shabbos, when you know, times we weren't going to shul, sometimes I would actually say, you know, I'm going to say every word. I'm going to make sure I know what it means. I'm going to think about it. And literally it would take me longer than the regular time. I didn't always do that. And sometimes I skipped part of the davening, only said a little bit of Psukei Zimra. So I would say it for three times as long, but only say a third of Psukei Zimra. That's the first halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Aruch Haim, in Siman Aleph. It's better to daven a little bit less with kavana than a little bit more without kavana. It's quality over quantity in prayer. We know that. I mean, sometimes I've often said, you know, people say, you don't have to say every word. There are details. You have to know what you can and can't skip. But you don't have to say every word. It's much more important. Avodah Shabbalei, prayer is prayer of the heart. Rav Huttner, the Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin, apparently once made a cute quip when, you know, in some of the yeshivas, they skip a lot of the slichot. You know, a lot of the yeshivas, they weren't so into davening because they saw the Talmud even presents it. Okay, there's sort of a conflict between prayer and learning. You know, prayer is this worldly, learning is the next worldly, learning is, you know, spiritual. Amazingly, prayer is very, you know, I want to get wealthy, like more mundane. And of course, it takes time. So many of the yeshivot actually would daven quickly and they'd skip things. And those who've been to yeshivot know talking about sometimes they daven much longer. Depends on the place, etc. So Rav Huttner, a lot of yeshivas, they skip a lot of sefer. So Rav Huttner apparently made a quip. It's better to say a little with, it's better to say a little without kavana than a lot without kavana. If you're not going to have kavana anyways, it says in Shulchan Aruch, better say a little bit with kavana than a lot without kavana. So he says it's better to say a little bit without kavana than a lot without kavana. No. Anyway, so that's what can we do? That's unfortunately, that's the way it works. But was it connecting to, but getting back to the question of reward and you know, this problem of how do we solve it? So I will say the basic approach, or I don't know if there is an approach, but anyway, so that's if you want to know the true religiosity of a person, you really have to see how they act. So getting back to the Rav, what the Rav said about Rav Chaim, but he said, but sometimes it's not a contradiction. What you do in public, we know that people are inspired. that the same thing you do, you know why sometimes people, and I have this also sometimes that's occasionally I prayed at home and I daven with more kavana. Often I daven at home and it's much less, just let me get this over with, you know, chick chock, let me go as quickly as possible. It's not that that's necessarily a contradiction. And then when you go daven in public, daven slower. Sometimes it's the motivation. Sometimes it's the creating the ambiance. Obviously the whole idea of davening with the minyan is not to answer Amen. A lot of people think the main reason to daven with the minyan, to hear Kedusha, to hear Baruch Hu, that's a little bit, that's not the main reason. All the sources, the main reason we daven in a community is because there's a huge difference between me as an individual and Klal Yisrael. God made his covenant with the Jewish people. He didn't make an individual covenant with me and you. Yes, we have an idea of a personal relationship, but God's relationship is with the Jewish people as a Jewish people. And therefore you have to be connected to the people. Definitely with the minyan, because we believe God hears the prayers of a minyan much, much more than he hears the prayers of an individual. Or God's covenant, God won't destroy the Jewish people. That's not about any individual, that's on the people. So definitely the idea that you're Kaddish and Kedusha, that's a minor point. It's the real point is to daven in a group, and then we inspire each other. Depends on the shul you go to. Some shuls are uninspiring. It's harder to daven. Okay, that's a problem. We do some shuls more inspiring, less inspiring. But that's the idea of davening with a minyan, is that the davening will be much more enhanced and a much greater davening and a much greater chance of success. So anyways, but if you want to know the true measure of a person, you have to see them in all circumstances. I think that's what the Mishnah is saying. Kolam kaima oni. If you, some people, they're committed, they're going to keep Torah whenever, wherever, and that's why we know one who a thief who breaks into your house at night has to pay more than the guy who mugs you, right? Because he's hypocritical. He hides his sin. We discussed this also. The idea is to be open and be honest. The hypocritical, we don't like. A person sins, we're human beings, but to pretend you're somebody who you aren't, that you shouldn't do. And that relates, you know, how strict you should be, when you should take upon extra stringencies. There has to be a proper approach, a proper balance to your life, that it makes sense. Anyway, but just one idea, of course, that I'm sure it's you've heard perhaps before, doesn't really answer the question, but how could it be that a righteous person has to suffer and the wicked people prosper? Without that, it would take away our free choice, obviously. If every time a person sinned, they got, you know, struck by lightning, so to speak, after a while, you stop sinning. And if every time you did what's right, you got a reward, eventually you put two and two together. If every person who kept kosher lived to be 120, and people who didn't keep kosher died at 70, and, you know, eventually the scientists would figure out that, oh, if you only eat fish, you know, with fins and scales and meat that has a split hoof and chews its cud, you're going to live an extra 50 years. So, you know what, people would keep kosher, but that would be meaningless. So, we're not keeping kosher. So it has to be a situation where you often get, you know, clunked over the head for doing what's right. Doing what's right doesn't always help. And by the way, just aside, I'm sure people know the derivation of a minyan is this week's like Parsha. It's this week and last week with the Meraglim and Korach, which is a fascinating idea because we derived the Meraglim, that there were 10 bad Meraglim, so to speak. And that's the basis of our minyan. So what does that tell you? It tells you that it doesn't matter who the people are. As an individual, that's what when God looks at us as individuals, are we good or bad? A minyan can be the lowest of the low. They got killed. They were struck down for the evil that they did. They caused us to wander in the desert for 40 years. Nonetheless, 10 Jews come together. They can be the most wicked Jews in the world. And therefore, that's a minyan. And that minyan is who God has a relationship with and won't break that relationship. It's a beautiful idea. And the Talmud says, we're coming up, it's Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, with Chodesh, everybody, Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. So in 17 days, it's Shivasar B'Tammuz. And, what was I saying? Hold on. Why did I just lose my train of thought? Anybody paying attention? What was I saying? hold on a second. I'm sorry?
You were talking about the Meraglim.
Right.
The Minyan.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much. I totally forgot. I don't know what happened. Okay. It's hard sometimes on Zoom. Right. Talking about the Meraglim. So the Talmud says on a fast day, any fast day that doesn't have a sinner in shul is not a fast day. In other words, if you have a shul, the Gemara says there are 11 spices in the incense. The chalbana, 11 spices. That's interesting why 11, but one of them, the chalbana, had an awful smell. But if it doesn't, but when you mixed it in with everything else, it was okay. You didn't notice. So the Gemara says every community has to have the chalbana. It's not a community if you just have 10 righteous people who daven together. So the idea is minyan means the Jewish people, and Jewish people have good and bad and wicked and all everything in between. So that's what makes a minyan. So it's interesting. We derive minyan mainly from the Meraglim, and then from what it says in tomorrow's parsha, hibatlu mitocha eida hazot. Eida and eida, and eida is 10 a congregation. But anyways, that's our relationship to God is much stronger as far as we're part of a community. Yes, so Zav is pointing out that people overeat and drink too much despite scientific evidence. Yes, that is true. So you're saying even if we knew we could live 50 years long, by keeping kosher might not work. Okay, that's probably true, although it probably worked for some people. I think I went to mention, I have to relook up the survey that they asked Olympic athletes, right, if they would take steroids, a pill, that they they could win the gold medal, help them win the gold medal, but it would kill them within 10 years. They would die from the side effects. Would they do it? And apparently, from when I remember reading it years ago, it said half the Olympic athletes said they would take it. Their purpose in life is to win a gold medal. I don't know that they would say it 10 years later when they're 22 years old and running 9.74 in the 100 meters and they could get a gold medal. You win the gold medal, world's fastest man, and you win, get $25 million in endorsements. So you die a little earlier. What's the big deal? So I hear that point, but I still think there is, if we always got rewarded for doing well, maybe the kashrut example isn't such a great example. It would help. Okay. Any other questions? Feel free to interrupt, say something. And thank you, Faye, for getting me back on track. Okay. Let's continue Mishnah Yud. Rabbi Meir Omer, Rabbi Memai Be'esek Vasok B'Torah. Seems to be continuing the same theme. Memai Be'esek, do less in business and get involved in Torah. So first of all, just a couple words. We always like to tell who the sages are, who are speaking. By the way, the last Mishnah was Rav Yonatan. So Rav Yonatan's very unknown figure. This is the only time he appears in the Mishnah. This is it. We mentioned that there are like 20 rabbis only appear in Pirkei Avot, and he appears in Pirkei Avot and only once in Pirkei Avot, Rav Yonatan. I believe he was a student of Rabbi Yishmael, that's Rabbi Akiva's contemporary, but I would say one of the lesser known of our sages. Rabbi Meir, of course, is probably one of the best known. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says that Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. When you have an anonymous Mishnah, most of the Mishnayot are anonymous. It's a statement. And then if there's a debate, they quote the rabbis who debate. But most Mishnayot just quote opinion, just quote a law. So that's assumed. That was from the teaching of Rabbi Meir. Because the Mishnah, it's not that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi woke up one day and he said, okay, I'm going to edit the Mishnah. And he spent a few years. That's Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. There was a lot of work. The work started really after the Bar Kokhba revolt. The rabbis realized that the end is near. I guess the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, they thought through Yavne, they could recreate it. I guess it didn't happen then. But I think after the Bar Kokhba revolt, 135, the Hadrianic persecution, the rabbis recognized that the oral transmission is not going to work. And they started to collate all the learning. And that was really Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva began the process. Of course, he was killed then, but he sort of initiated a little bit. And then it's his students, Rav Meir, one of his students who did a lot of the work. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the final editor. I mean, he did a lot of the work, of course. I don't think any of us know exactly how they edited, but Rabbi Meir collated, put into chapters and stuff. So Rabbi Meir is, of course, one of the most important sages in the Mishnah. The Gemara in Eruvin has a couple of quite amazing comments about it. They say his name wasn't Meir. There's a three-way debate what his real name was. So why was he called Meir? Shemeir Einei Chachamim B'Chochma. He lit up the eyes of our sages in wisdom. Meir is a nickname, light. He brought the light of Torah to the people. And then the Talmud says, you know what, Rav Meir, he was like in another league. He was so brilliant. Ein adam yoreit l'sof dato. Nobody could understand him. No, nobody could fully appreciate what he said. He would say, al tamei tahor, v'al tahor tamei. He had the ability to say, explain why something not kosher is kosher and why something kosher isn't kosher. The Gemara has such an expression that a judge, a dayan, has to be, you have to always be able to see the other side. But Rav Meir could explain, give you 50 arguments why a sheretz, a rodent, is pure. Now, there's a verse in the Torah that tells us a rodent is impure, but Rav Meir was smart enough to, we all do that. You know, the verse doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that. He could do that. The rabbi said he was too in his own league. We don't follow him in halakha because we can't fully understand what he meant. You know, the greatness of Rav Soloveitchik was he could explain. We all know that, you have great, great people. I don't know if this is exactly what they mean by Rav Meir, that he couldn't explain things. I think his views were just so wild, or he had the ability, but it could also mean that he, people couldn't fully understand what he meant. But Rav Soloveitchik had such clarity. But I remember Rav Schechter once told us that, I assume he meant this, jokingly, but the idea that Rav Soloveitchik was so convincing, and if anybody heard him speak, besides being a phenomenal orator, everything was so beautiful, and it was simple. After he finished a drush, he figured, why didn't I think of that? After he said it, it was so obvious. Oh, that extra word in the Rambam. He presented it in such beautiful ways that made it so obvious. And he was so convincing. So Rav Schechter said one that Rav Soloveitchik could convince you in June that it was snowing outside. You look outside and it's raining, and he'd convince you it was snowing. He had that ability. So that's sort of like Rav Meir. So the Talmud says, we don't follow his views in halakha. General. The Gemara has one of his names was Nahurai. He was also from the same light up, Nahor, light up. Then some say he was Rav Elazar ben Aruch. That leads us to a whole other discussion. Rav Elazar ben Aruch is one of the tragic figures, perhaps the most tragic figure, the Mishnah, next to Elisha ben Avuya, the famous heretic, the good friend of Rav Meir, Rav Meir's teacher, Elisha ben Avuya, who becomes a heretic. So that would be interesting. The Gemara has an opinion that Rabbi Meir was Rav Elazar ben Aruch. When Elazar ben Aruch is the one who Rav Yochanan, one view that was the top student of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai.
And then he forgot everything, right?
Right, he forgot everything. He's the one who went to the country club. The Gemara says he went to this town where they had all the fancy things, and he lived in a resort town, and they lived it up. He had the great, and he forgot everything. It's unbelievable Gemara. The Gemara says he came back after 10 years. Listen, these stories cannot be literal 100%. So they gave him an aliyah in shul. I guess it was Parshat HaChodesh. So instead of reading HaChodesh Hazel Lachem, he read HaCheresh HaYalibam. Now, the Ched and the Dalet are very similar. Chodesh Cheresh. Lachem Libam, it's very similar, but of course it's a beautiful idea. He became deaf, he became Cheresh and Chorish Libam, his heart was closed. So that, the Gemara has this tragic story about Rav Elazar ben Aruch. So there was a funny view, the Gemara in Eruvin says that his name wasn't Meir. They called him Meir because he lit up the eyes of the sages. Some say his name was Rav Nahurai, and some say his name was Rav Elazar ben Aruch. It's very strange. It doesn't appear to be the simple pshat. Why should we assume Meir's Rav Elazar ben Aruch? So unless you want to say, I don't know. This is a whole other shir. I don't really want to go there, but I'll throw it out there. We know, of course, Rabbi Meir had a wonderful wife, a very famous wife, in Bruria. Sure. And we know that there, the Talmud, this is really requires its own shir for another time. As a matter of fact, Eitan Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, who was, murdered with his wife, I'm sure you all know, a few years ago in a terrorist attack. And besides, of course, the terrible personal tragic loss, obviously, both parents are killed for orphans left. And he was such a loss to Klal Yisrael. This is, he was really going to be a Gadol B'Yisrael for sure. For sure. He was like in his early 30s and what he had already published, and he combined, I think I mentioned this once, his brother at the funeral said that in the Henkin family, they went from great Torah scholar to great academic. Like Rav Eliyahu Yosef Henkin was Rav Moshe Feinstein, the the most important poskim ever in America. Rav Hengen died 10 years earlier, 12 years earlier, so he's not quite as famous. But him and Rav Moshe were the two most important halachic authorities. And his son was a professor at Columbia University, major professor for religious math, I mean, of course. And then the son, and then Rav Yehuda Herzl Hengen, who just passed away a few months ago. He was back, you know, on the Talmud Chacham sort of level. And he said, Eitan helped. He was both. He was both. He was a brilliant academic, and he wrote Aruch Shulchan, tons of stuff he left in manuscripts, and really. So he has a whole article on this very strange Rashi, Bruria, that what happened at the end of Bruria's life, and it has to do with a whole story that Rav Meir tried to get somebody to seduce his wife because Bruria was, she was too smart for herself. And he wanted to show a woman, you know, what did they think they're not good. So he got somebody to sexually seduce her to have an affair. And then they had to run away. It's like you read the story. This is like nuts. And people use that story to people who don't like woman learning often will quote. It's not in the Gemara. The story's not in the Gemara. It's in Rashi. Rashi. The Gemara says, Ma'aseh Shahaya. They had to leave town. Something happened. But the Gemara doesn't explain. So Rashi explains this in Avodah Zarah. So Eitan Hankin has a whole convincing article where he shows, this was a scribal error. This was put in. This was not plagiarism. It's not Rashi. I'm sorry? Somebody put it in, but I just throw that Rav Meir is a very, I don't want to say he is a complicated figure. His relationship with Elisha ben Avuya, and even his relationship with his wife. Well, we do know, I mean, his wife had to straighten him out. We read this morning, Barki Nafshi, the end of Rosh Chodesh, we say the beautiful, beautiful Psalm 104, one of those, you know, beautiful Tehillim, Barki Nafshi at Hashem. So it ends, Yitamucha Taimin Arz Yishra Marinam, that the sinners or sin should be removed from the land. And that's the famous story. Rav Meir prayed for the death of the sinners. And Brewer said, you're wrong. It's sins, not sinners. So why didn't Rav Meir realize that? That took Bruria. And then the tragic story, they lost two children and how Bruria told, he came, you know, on Shabbos. And so Bruria said to Rav Meir, what would you do if somebody gave you a gift? And said, you know, one day I'm going to want the gift back. And you have it for as long as you say, okay. When the person asks for the gift back, are you upset at them? He says, no, of course. It's there. That's what they gave it to me on condition. So that's what Bruria said, the gift of the children, and God took back the gift. Bruria was sort of, is presented as having, I don't know, more worldly wisdom. I don't know what exactly the word is. And perhaps I have to reread this article I read a number of years ago by Eitan Hankin on this, but perhaps this is somebody putting it in, you know, they didn't like this about Bruria, but the Gemara does say that we don't follow Rav Meir, and there is one view, he was Rav Elazar ben Arach. The Gemara doesn't say he ever became a heretic, no, not at all. It just said he left learning, he left the world of learning, because we never hear from him again. He's mentioned in Pirkei Avot, him or Rav Elazar HaGadol debate who's the greatest student of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. Some say if all the students are on one side, Rav Elazar ben Arach, and then you never hear from him. There's not mention of Mishnah, whatever happened to him. So the Gemara presents this story. Again, is it literal? You know, he sort of, I don't want to say he went off the derech, you know, but in other words, he became interested in having a nice life and he stopped learning Torah. So there's one view. It doesn't seem to, I don't fully understand it, but that's one view in the Talmud. Anyways, but Rav Meir is one of the sort of founding people writing of the Mishnah, and he is Meir Einei Chachamim B'Halacha. He lightens up the rabbis, and it's Rav Meir, and this fits in, this is important for our Mishnah, who says that a person should teach his son, Olam Yomar Adam, Ebeno Umenot Nikia V'Kala. So, the Talmud is 2,711 double-sided pages, right? Everybody knows that. Daf Yomi, you know, 7.5 years. I don't know if everybody knows that, but 2,700. I didn't know that either till Daf Yomi became very popular. That so they say, you know, when they finish 2,711. That's thanks to Daniel Blomberg, the non-Jew. The non-Jews originated Daf Yomi because it's how he printed it. The Vilna Shas changed it a bit, but Daniel Bomberg in 1523 printed the Talmud with whatever, 2,000 pages. I don't know the exact number. It changed a little. But had Daniel Bomberg decided to put the Rush on the side of the Gemara, that's what the Maharal was very upset. The Maharal was very upset that they put Tosfon on the side. It's too dialectic. It's too, he doesn't belong inside. Whatever, it's how the non-Jew printer printed the Talmud. That's how Daf Yomi came about. What can you say? Anyways, but in the 2,711 pages of Talmud, there's like one page that the Talmud talks about what a person should do. Career planning, guidance. You go to your guidance counselor, what to do for a career. Now, why is there nothing in there? Because the Gemara, the Torah doesn't care what you do. That's what I mean. Torah doesn't care what you do. Torah says do whatever profession you want to do. You have to work for a living. You have to support your family. But we don't tell you what to do. Whatever you do, do properly. I know Meir Tamari had that in one of his books on economics. One of the people very involved in economics and Jewish law says the Torah doesn't. Some people, it's a Torah capitalistic, socialistic. You know what economic systems are. His basic thesis: the Torah doesn't care. The Torah just says, whatever system you have, you have to take care of the poor and you have to make sure the economy runs smoothly. You're entitled. The people who run it are entitled to, you know, what percentage of taxes the rich should pay. I see this week, the New York Times, a whole expose. I don't know, they got the tax returns, you know, how, you know, the richest Americans pay next to nothing. And, you know, we'll see if that changed. Everybody knows that. But I guess now that they released the actual tax returns, so people are upset for good reason. You know, the rich are getting, you know, they have all the loopholes. Warren Buffett for years was saying his secretary pays more in taxes than he does, you know, but at $40,000 a year, she pays more in taxes than he does at, you know, $5 billion a year, whatever it is. But anyways, the system is less important. I mean, that's probably an inequity that the Torah would say you have to fix. But the system is less important than what you do. So the Torah doesn't give us career planning. The Torah doesn't tell us career planning. Whatever career you do, do it ethically, do it morally. Nonetheless, there is one page, the Gemara does have at the end of Kiddushin, interesting, the last page in Kiddushin. So the Gemara lists certain things. So it says if you have a temper, so become a shochet. So then you can take out your anger on the animal. You can slaughter some animals. And then the Gemara recommends, that's where the Gemara says, by the way, we many schools totally violate this. Many schools violate this against the halakha. I don't know what their excuse is. I mean, I can make up an excuse, but a single person is not allowed to become a teacher, at least not of people of the opposite sex. A single man is not allowed to teach women. And a single woman is not allowed to teach men. Gemara was concerned. We know how true it is. I mean, you know, sexual abuse, and it tends, I don't know if it's more common among religious leaders, but it's certainly no less common among religious leaders than other people. So the Gemara there has a prohibition about you have to be married if you want. And then the Gemara was, even if it's like little kids. So Gemara, I guess it didn't enter the Gemara's mind that people would abuse, you know, your six-year-old kids. We know tragically that isn't true. The Gemara's concern was on parent-teacher night. That you know, the man is single, and the calls up the mother for the, you know, and then they couldn't call on the phone. They had to meet. So his girl in grade one. So he meets with the mother, you know, and so that's, the Gemara prohibits that. So it's interesting. So the Gemara has a few different discussions there. What a person should do for a living. So Rav Meir says a person should do umnat nekiya v'kala. Doesn't, again, that doesn't tell you what to do. You should do a clean and easy work. Now, what that is and how that works today is probably next to impossible. Nekiya v'kala means certain, everybody knows, certain businesses are much more corrupt than others. The temptation to cheat, the culture of cheating or cutting corners, we all know, is much more prevalent in certain industries than in others. So Rameyer says, avoid those industries. They may change over time. And should, that's an umnat nekiya, it should be clean. And an umnat kala should be, you don't have to work 90 hours a week to make a living. So the problem is, and that's really the problem in this Mishnah, having mima'ayt be'esek. So Rameyer, I think it's really combined with that Mishnah in Kiddushin. that he says, una kala v'nikia. In other words, you have to work a little bit. The Rambam, that's like, you can laugh. It's like, you know, like we laugh at this. The Rambam says a person, yeah, of course you have to work. The Rambam, you know, was the most against, we've discussed, the most against taking money for teaching. The Rambam says one who takes money for teaching Torah loses his share in the world to come. Like the Rambam really didn't like to take money. He was like, you know, he's the poster person for never taking a penny for teaching Torah. So you have to go to work. So, okay, so how much do you have to work? So now, by the way, you can take private money. If your brother, that's how the Rambam lived until his brother drowned. That's the famous, if someone in your family, he means to take community money, charity money. If your brother says, you're a great Torah scholar, you know, I want you to sit and learn. I was getting back, that was common. In Ashkenazi, you know, Jewry, mentioned the Balei HaTosfa before, in Ashkenazi Jewry apparently was quite common. From what I read, is that in every family or in many families, you know, who's the brightest kid in the family? And if they would sort of have, you know, informal agreements or formal agreements that most families, the super genius or the brightest kid would dedicate his life to learning and the rest of the family would support this family. And he would learn on behalf. So that's fine. That's because that's not, you're not going in the community. That's not, people in the family want to give money. We want somebody to learn in our family. We're not cut out for learning. You're cut out for learning. So that's a beautiful idea. That's a beautiful idea. But to take community funds, the Rambam says you lose your share in the world to come. Nope. So the Rambam was supported by his brother. His brother drowned on a business trip. So the Rambam had to make a living. Okay, so, you know, what can I do easily? I'll go to medical school, you know, if you're the Rambam. So the Rambam becomes a doctor. And I don't exactly know when the first medical school is open. I have to ask Eddie Reichman, you know, when the first medical, like a school is open, opposed to train, whatever, the Rambam becomes a doctor. Now, the Rambam himself didn't follow what he's about to write. The Rambam says, the brightest meal, yeah, we'll get there. The Rambam says that, so yeah, I got to work. Okay, so go to work for 3 hours a day and learn 9 hours a day. According to Rambam, you have to sleep 8 hours a day. All right, that's what the Rambam recommends. Very interesting. So you sleep 8 hours a day, you learn 9 hours a day, you work 3 hours a day, that's 20 hours. You have 4 hours, you know, to eat, to talk to the family, to play baseball, whatever, you got the other 4 hours a day. That's how the Rambam sets up your schedule. Nunu, so that's, nobody follows that. That's impossible. It's so impossible. The Rambam didn't follow it. So that's what the Bartanura says. What does Rav Meir say? You should spend more time, we discussed in prayer, quality is more important than quantity. And I guess on a certain level, that's true in learning too, but on a certain level, not. And a certain level, the process of learning is more important than the outcome of learning. That's in a nutshell, why yeshivas focus on Talmud. If you want to be practical, Talmud is not so practical to learn. You learn halakha. If you want to know how to live your life as a Jew. Matter of fact, I mean, Rav Avadya Yosef was opposed to Daf Yomi. He said, most people learn Daf Yomi. That's the only learning they do. It's true. The 90% of the learning they do is Daf Yomi. And what do they gain from it? It's too fast. They remember here and there. They don't know how to live their life. They don't know halakha. Rav Avadya Yosef said, a mistake. They should learn an hour halakha. But of course, Rav Avadya Yosef, I don't want to say, but it's not correct. Psychologically, it won't work. People won't learn an hour of halakha day, but Daf Yomi, it's that, you know, that being in with the crowd, the minyan, that's what we say, the community doing it, it's a goal, people are motivated that way. So that's what the greatness of Daf Yomi is. But here, so he's saying, so quantity of time, so you know a little, it's not so much, you know, how much you gain. We'll get there in a second, but it's the quantity of time. So the part in the Rav Meir says, "Mema'if asek, spend less time in your business dealings and more time learning." No, no. So I would say, of course, that has to be updated because today in Umnat Kala V'Nikia, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Rabbi Drach at a panel we had a few years ago said that the biggest problem facing the Orthodox community in America is that people can only become lawyers, doctors, or investment bankers because that's the only field you can make enough money to support a day school education. If you want, you know, so it's a sack. Yeah, a Jew wants to be a social worker, you know, or even a teacher. Then he wants to have four kids in the day school system. That's $100,000 a year. That's more than 100% of their salary. So you have a little bit of a problem there. So it is a real problem. He said that's the biggest challenge facing the Orthodox community. One of the biggest challenges. That's not normally how people think. not saying, but he wanted to throw that out there. It was a panel discussion we were having on what are the challenges we face as a community. So with the singles crisis, this crisis, that, this, he said, you know, and crisis is that you can't have normal, you know, people are locked into careers that they don't want to do. We've lost, we can't have Jewish artists here or all kinds of things. Baruch Hashem, you can have them in Israel. But that's a whole different story. Okay, anyways, so and be very humble. So we already had this before in the Mishnah Dalit, be shval ruach, shatikvat enosh rima, because the hope of man is maggots in the grave. So the commentaries explain that is general arrogance. When he says, be very, very humble, that's because we're all going to die. You know, we're here today, gone tomorrow. This is a different type. This is a knowledge arrogance that heavy shvav ruach b'fnei kol adam. And there's even people who asok b'Torah, be involved in Torah, and be very humble for everybody. Even the guy learns less than you. Again, the stressing learning from your student. What I think it's a Bartanura says, I think a very beautiful comment. The Mishnah says a person should do less in business and more learning, more study. And we know most people don't do that, as we're going to see in 1 second. Most people don't do that. The person who doesn't learn at all, makes a lot of money, they honor him at the dinner or whatever, be shvav ruach before them too. In other words, be humble even toward, in other words, be humble, be respectful, look at the positive in even people who ignore the teachings of. But if somebody isn't, still be very humble, can, because as the Mishnah continues, vim batalta b'Torah, if you nullify the Torah, we have to figure out what that word means, bitul Torah. It's used today very, you know, in yeshivas, they say, what are you wasting your time? Just learn Torah. Every, you know, 10 minutes doing this, it's bitul Torah to watch a hockey game, whatever. I don't know that that's the real meaning of bitul Torah. And bitul Torah means to nullify, like we take our chametz and we say it's worthless, it's meaningless, I don't want to have anything to do with it. I think the person who doesn't learn so much because it's hard for him, he's not interested, that's not nullifying the Torah. Maybe a wonderful person, just it's not for him. So I don't know that's real. Bitul Torah, I think, is much more negative than the way we often refer to it, I think, in, you know, today. But in the context of the Mishnah, also, in batalta min Torah, but if you do nullify, you don't, you know, study Torah at all, like, you have a lot of people who also are bitul Torah. In other words, most people don't do it. You have a lot of people, you're in good company. So in other words, we're warning you, just because you're in good company doesn't mean that's what you should do. Now, or as the Bartanura says, you have a lot of people to help you. You know, I wanna skip school and do this. You can easily find a friend who'll skip with you. You've got a lot of betalim kinegdecha. Kineged, the word neged means alongside. You have a lot of people alongside with you, kinegdecha. The Tiferet Yisrael says the exact opposite. He uses the word neged in biblical Hebrew has two meanings. It means alongside, with you, supporting, and neged means against you. So he says, in batalta. So the Bartanura understands the Mishnah alongside you. If you want to do bitul Torah, you got lots of people to join you. And that's the crowd. You know, that's many more people are watching the Super Bowl or even some third rate, like baseball game than go to a shir. You know, people are excited. 100 people go to shir. Wow, that's amazing. Well, you know, 50,000 people go to a baseball game at Yankee Stadium, you know, like, so many more. Okay, I know that's not exactly a fair comparison, but you understand what I'm trying to say. You got lots of people who will join you. Now, the Deferet Yisrael says, kinegdecha, against you. So what does he say? If a person is mevatel Torah, it's very hard to come back. We all know this. You get in a rut, or if God forbid, a person becomes an addict, gambling, alcohol, whatever problem they have, it's very hard. Often they have to hit rock bottom before they can improve. So in batalta b'Torah, if you pushed aside the Torah, Torah is not important to you. It's going to, yeshecha b'teilim harbe kenegdecha. There are going to be so many obstacles against you when you want to come back. And the Tiferet Yisrael uses the example, it's like a funny example to show this point. The idea that the Gemara says, if it rains on Sukkot, That's like a master. That's a curse. God told us to eat in the sukkah, and then he makes it rain. So we have to come inside the house. So it's like a master asks a slave, bring me a glass of water. He brings him a glass of water and he throws it in his face. To show, totally disrespectful. So that's what the Tiferet Yisrael says here in our Mishnah. But Talta B'Torah, it's like, you want to come back? Oh, we're going to throw it. It's not, wait a minute, you can't just come back. We make choice A, then choices B, C, and D are often made for us. That's how life works. Often you make one choice and that's it. So Yeshecha B'Teim Harvei Kenegdecha. So he's using Keneged in the opposite sense. And just to point out a couple other examples, I think. So probably the most famous example where Keneged has this, you know, dual meaning is Ezer Kenegdo. It's not good for a man to be alone. S-L-O, Ezer Kenegdo. I'll make him. So how do you translate Ezer Kenegdo? So they know, I think the English, what a helpmate, right? So Ezer Kenegdo means someone who supports the husband. Okay, I'm not getting into all the, you know, the relationship equality and, you know, how that sounds today. Forget that. We can talk about that another time. Ezer Kenegdo means they are partners. They're partners. Ezer Kenegdo, somebody who helps along. But the Nefsif writes, no, the role of a spouse, let's not just say wife, the role of a spouse sometimes is to be connected, is to be a constructive critic. The idea is don't marry, you should marry somebody or the spouse's role is to critique you and to improve you as a person. Everybody has their own talent. Like Rav Meir and Bruria. Rav Bruria said, and the Rav Meir, you're wrong. Don't curse out the people. So Ezer Kenegdo, the way you help somebody is being opposed to them. Again, you have to know where to draw the line. So the word Keneged has this dual meaning. I think the most amazing example, and that's from this, I first read it here, this book, Nishmat Abraham, which was given to me as a gift for those who are on our Tehillim course. Benny Gesundheit, who taught Tehillim course for 30 weeks, when he left Toronto after 3 years, he was here, you know, that's how we met. He was spent 3 years in Toronto, the kids' hospital and getting a PhD on the side at U of T. So he gave me this book by Avraham, Nishmat Avraham, a 6-volume work where he goes through the Shulchan Aruch, and then he writes all the medical stuff, anything medical related on the bottom. So on the first page, everybody knows. The first, I mentioned in Siman Aleph, it says you should daven more, you should daven less with Kavana than more without Kavana. That's a little bit later in the first Siman. The first words are of the Ramah. Yikaber Kari, wake up like a lion. That's how the Shulchan Aruch begins. And then the Ramah says, Shiviti Hashem l'negdi tamid hukla gadol b'Torah. God, Shiviti Hashem l'negdi tamid. God is before me always. I think in many shuls, they have that on the Aron Kodesh. God is always, you always should feel God is before you. You know, what would God say? You know, when they want to do something, put God in front of you. Shiviti Hashem l'negdi tamid. So he quotes here in the footnote, the Nishmat Abraham, the Abraham, he quotes from the Tshuva Me Ahava. I love that name. The Tshuva Me Ahava was written by Rav Yecheskel Fleklis, 18th century. He was a student of the Noda Yehuda, the great famous sage, Noda Yehuda, Rav Yecheskel Landau, who was the chief rabbi in Prague. And Rav Yecheskel Fleklis, I don't know if he succeeded him or there was somebody in the interim, but he also became the chief rabbi of Prague. We're talking now early 1800s. And he wrote a tshuva, sefer, Tshuva Me Ahava, the responses out of love. And in his introduction, he writes that we should interpret this verse, Shiviti Hashem l'negdi tamid, that God is opposed to me. God is keneged. Shiviti Hashem should always pretend that God is opposed to you. What does that mean? It means like this, when things are going really well, a person should think, you know, maybe it's going really well because God, you know, the money's going to lead me astray or God's giving me all my rewards now. And if I'm very poor, maybe see it as a punishment. In other words, you should always see life. Maybe this is hard and maybe this is kind of even depressing on a certain level. But the idea is that in other words, we have to live our life like we sometimes, I would add, I don't know if we have to fight God sometimes. In other words, we have to, you know, what's the whole idea of Bichiv Shuha, to conquer the world? It means God created an incomplete world. God, well, if God doesn't want this, you know, God said that Eve should suffer, women should suffer in childbirth. So how can you go to Lamaze classes? I know that's what they had years ago. I don't know what they have today, you know, and not to, you know, and to make it easier and that, well, it's against God. No, we can be against God when it's for the good of man. But that's one aspect. But he was saying it on a moral sort of ethical plane. And whatever happens here in life, don't say, oh, God is, you know, I'm living a good life. See, God gave me a beautiful house, a beautiful family, all these things. God must really like me, and therefore you don't examine your ways. But if you say that what I'm getting from God may be not for my benefit, maybe God wants to tell me a message, the danger of wealth. So I just find that, I don't know, think of it what you may, but the point is the word keneged, it's such a beautiful idea. Yeah, this often, there are two, it's the same word, it can mean two polar opposites, but the opposites are the same. They're really, I mean, two sides of the same coin. Your spouse is with you, helping you, and your spouse is against you. But of course, by being against you, they're helping you. They're not doing it to be against you. And the reason God is doing this, quote unquote, against me is not to make me suffer. The reason God is doing it is because he wants to help me become a better person. So that's Yesh. Yesh l'chag v'telim harbe kinagdecha. There are lots of people who are also violator kinegdecha. Okay, I see it's 10:27. So just let me quickly review and take any questions you might have, and we'll continue next week. We always do less mishnayot than we think, but that's a good thing. Okay, and always, you know, things come up, but you know, as I speak, you know, my train of thought sometimes, you know, go off, you know, little tangents. Okay, but we discussed a little the problem of reward and punishment, that the Mishnah doesn't appear to be true, that if you go from wealth to, you keep Torah when you're poor, you'll become wealthy, and if you don't keep Torah when you're wealthy, you become poor. We just see it isn't true. So we discussed maybe the Mishnah doesn't even mean that. It just means a person who keeps the Torah in situation way, who's truly a Torah observant Jew, will always keep the Torah. It's not a question of reward and punishment. And even if it is, we don't understand God's ways. Maybe the person did it for the wrong reason, shalom lishma. Maybe that impacts on them. And how important is our proper motivation? We don't understand anything what's going on. Maybe it's to keep the notion of free choice alive. Okay, that's then we discussed Rav Meir a little bit. Who's brilliant? Who is Rav Meir? The idea that, I didn't quite say it this way, but the idea that a great teacher and a great posek has to be someone who the people understand what he's saying, what he wants. Rav Meir was so above the people that they couldn't follow him, even the sages. So we couldn't follow his views. And we discussed the complexity of his life, his relationship with his wife, his relationship with Elisha ben Avia, possibly himself, becomes Rav Elezer ben Arach, being a Shval Ruach, always, even people who don't follow the Torah, we should be humble in front of them. We shouldn't look down. Maybe Shval Ruach, we can always learn from anybody. We can learn from sinners. And whatever God gives us in life, we should see it as a challenge to do a little bit better. That's how I would say maybe what the Tshuva Me'ava is saying. It's a challenge to do that. Okay, there. If anybody wants to speak up, fine, but just let me quickly take a look at the questions, or not so quickly. What about geographical differences? We started throughout Hilltop Valley, correct. That is, today we don't live like that. We look at we type in my zmanim, we look in the calendar when Lech mentioned it, but in the Talmud, they talk about that. Absolutely, there was a difference when Shabbos started. You were the beginning of the, in the valley or mountain. That's an important question when you fly on an airplane. I, at least twice, have flown in airplanes on Shiva Sarvatam was leaving Toronto when I had our summer trips, you know, in the days when we were traveling, please God, you know, soon. So, you know, often we would travel right after Shiva Sarvatam was, so I go day earlier. So there were a couple of times I broke my fast on the airplane. So you have to figure out, your plane leaves at 6 o'clock and it's at 9:30 in Toronto, the fast end. When exactly does it end when you're in the sky? So yes, these things are interesting points, and I think there's a whole app for that. You give them the plane route. I don't know. I looked outside the plane. It was dark, so you know. I mean, I looked whatever. I figured out how far we traveled. I hope I did it right. I was probably stricter than I had to be. I don't know. Okay, people smoke. Yeah, we discussed that. About half of NFL players, average of all players, career less than 5 years. Correct. Most athletes, their careers are very short. The famous athletes, their careers are long because there's Roger Federer is turning 40. He withdrew from the fourth round of the French Open. I mean, these guys, Nadal and Is Serena Williams, is she out or in? I don't know. Or I don't know what happened to her. I wouldn't follow if she made it far. But whatever. Yeah,
She lost.
Oh, she lost. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't hear. But, you know, and the Wayne Gretzky's or the Joe DiMaggio's, whatever, the great people, you know, they're the exceptions. Most athletes have very short careers. Okay. Have knee problems, major one. Correct. There's a whole thing of what's going on, concussions in hockey. And there is a lot of talk in football for sure. And people have donated their brains. They have this special brain disease because they get concussed. And you're right. We are very short thinking people. We don't think long term, and it's hard. You have to balance it. But 100. So maybe my statement was too strong. Maybe the answer isn't good enough. But you understand what I'm saying. The point is that there has to be some randomness from our point of view. But yeah, okay. You might want to forget everything given what happened to the Suns. I mean, I assume you're talking about Rob Mayer. Yeah, Ramirez was a great person. I'm just saying there's one view that he was Rav Elazar ben Aruch, a very strange view. And I'm assuming it's a minority view. The Gemara quotes that view in Eirvin. It's one view that he was Rav Elazar ben Aruch. And I don't even think that view necessarily means it necessarily literally. It means he also at some point had to leave. He went to Asia Minor. Because of the Romans, he had to leave town. But Rav Meir, really, if Stam Mishnah could Rav Meir, you know, that he started to put together the Mishnah. But yes, we can never judge people. Never judge people. I mean, the tragedy, you know, Rav Yochanan lost 10 sons. That's what the Gemara says. It's really, I mean, Rav Yochanan lived a very long life. So he lived to be like 100, but still. So it's not whatever. And the Gemara says he used to carry around the tooth of his youngest son. That was his remark. It's a very tragic story. I pointed out it's Rav Yochanan is the one who teaches, and I think it's not a coincidence, that when a person quotes somebody who's no longer living, their lips move in the grave. When we quote Rashi, it's a beautiful Gemara, I think in Yevamos, I think it's in Yevamos 105. The Gemara says when you quote somebody, so siftatov dovavot bekever, his lips move. You're keeping that person alive. And the fact that was Rav Yochanan who taught that teaching, and the Gemara says he lost 10 sons. I think that's a connection. When you talk about the person, that's what people do on a yahrzeit. People do, you know, you keep the person alive. Yeah, but anyways, okay, yes. So we never judge people. Rabbi Tolushkin disputes with the Rashi regarding Bruria, right? Okay, I don't know. You can send me which book in Rabbi Tolushkin, but Eitan Halpern has Eitan Henkin has a whole article on that, and he shows that it's sort of forged. It isn't correct. Do I recall the name of Rav Eitan Henkin's article on Rashi? You know what? I will try. If you send me an email, I will try to find it. If you type in his name, there is a website that has many of his articles, and I believe that's where you can find it. I know they put some of his articles, but I have up there, he wrote a whole book on Hilchot Shabbos. I'm sure it's amazing that somebody at this age wrote the way he wrote it is beyond belief. Okay, Rambam fled Cordova up north to Christian Spain after his bar mitzvah. It was probably after he was 10. We used to think the Rambam was born in 1135. We know he left Spain in 1148, the Almohad invasion, but recent scholarship has proven that he left, he was born only 1138. In other words, he was 3 years younger when he did everything. So the Rambam fled Cordova in Spain. He was in Fez for a while. We had our Morocco trip 2 summers ago. We're talking about a trip to Morocco, go to Fez, where the Rambam spent time, where the Rif was, and learned medicine from them from 1148. Yeah, 1148, he was too young to learn medicine. I don't know at what age Rambam learned. That's an interesting question I have to check. But his brother did support him for a number of years. And then, unfortunately, there was a shipwreck on one of his business trips. And right, that was the other thing I forgot to review, getting paper Torah and the family. That's all very nice. And then he learned medicine. But if you have more information, I'd love to hear. You can send it to me. Do any issue with monitoring to see how much time their students study? Do any? I'm sure some do. Is it half or overall? Yeah, the accountability. We'll pick. I have a few notes. I wanted to discuss that. This last part of the mission, the Imam Malta Batura. Please God, we'll pick up on that next week. That modern thing. I will say in Yeshiva University, and I was in the Gros Kollel, Yeshiva University gives you tests, you know, all the time. Rav Schachter would give us 4 or 5 tests a year. I remember Rav Lichtenstein gave us 2 oral tests a year when I was in Gris. So believe me, an oral test from Rav Lichtenstein, like, you better come well prepared. That's how the old smicha used to be, you know, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Mendel Zaks, and who was the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, became the Mashgiach at YU, and Dr. Belkin, who was an Eloi Yatsum. Dr. Belkin was beyond an Eloi, but he became the president of Yeshiva University, his learning staff, pretty much. I mean, you know, Rav Soloveitchik applied, it's well known, in 1941, after Dov Revel died, the first president. So the main candidates for the job of president of Yeshiva University, it's 1941, okay? So Rav Soloveitchik is 38. He hasn't started teaching at YU yet, or maybe he just started teaching. We're Leo Young of the Jewish Center. That's the Jewish Center is always a good stepping stone to be, you know, president of Yeshiva University. The Jewish Center in Manhattan, Leo Young, was there for, you know, 95 years. He was Rabbi Emeritus when Rabbi Lam started in 1959, and he was Rabbi Emeritus when Rabbi Lam left in 1975. And he lived to be in his 90s, well into his 90s. So Leo Young and Rav Soloveitchik wanted the position as president of Yeshiva University. And thank God Rav Soloveitchik didn't get the position, because he wouldn't have been Rav Soloveitchik. I mean, even if he would have had the brilliance, he wouldn't have taught the way he taught all the learning and all the students. Just like, thank God he didn't become the chief rabbi. Dr. Belkin used to give a shir in yeshiva, used to give a gemara shir, and it became too much for him. And I don't know, maybe we lost a lot. It's always in life, you know, people have to, it's very important. Somebody's got to run the institution. So I don't know, but you have to monitor study. Yes, it's very important. We're in the public door, but that used to be the oral test. They used to give oral bechinas, and people were nervous. People were nervous before they got the oral bechina. Rav Lichtenstein also, but Baruch Hashem, that's the way it has to be. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Any other comments?
Sure. All right,
questions, criticisms. Yeah,
yes. You mentioned, you know, Ezer Kenegdo.
Yeah.
You have, from this week's Parsha, you have a very cute incident of Ezer Kenegdo of On Ben Pelas.
Yeah, correct. Oh, man, right. In the
On Ben Pelas.
That's right.
Was saved by his wife.
100%. Right. It's usually
and, some say that's a classic example of Ezer Kenegdo.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you very much. Yes, that's a great example. On Ben Pelet is mentioned at the beginning, and we never hear from him again because his wife straightened him out. What do you want? If Moshe wins, you're going to get swallowed up. And if Korach wins, you'll be a nobody. Yeah. So, thank you very much. Okay, everybody. Thank you, Faye. And thank you for your comment. And thank you for getting me back when I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
179. Thanks a lot. Shabbat shalom.
Okay. Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom.
Chodesh Tov, Sunday morning. Rabbi Lieptag at 11:15. And like I mentioned last night, for those, and I know a lot of people have left already, probably starting, we haven't found, a week from Monday, is Rabbi Alex Israel is going to give a 7-part series on the thought, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. So, figure some Wonderful. People might be interested in that. And we'll send you more details. And thank you very much. Okay, everybody. Look forward to seeing you next week, and all the best. Mr. Zucker, yes, I, the class wouldn't be complete without your questions. At the end.
Thank you. Look, forgive my ignorance.
No, it's great. Questions are always good.
Rabbi Eitan Henkin, how is he connected with the famous Rabbi Henkin, one of the great poskim of the 20th
century? Yeah, it's his great-grandson.
Great-grandson. Look, just one of the family...
Hannah Henkin's son.
Oh, Hannah Henkin's son. Oh, okay.
In other words, the Eliyahu Yosef Henkin's son, I forget his name, was a professor, I think Louis Henkin, I don't know, was a professor at Columbia University. Yeah. His son, I was with Yehuda Herzl Henkin, went to Yeshiva Flatbush, learned with his grandfather, Megaliah, and together with his wife, you know, Chana, and Nishmad, and the Otzor Halacha program, he just passed away. And their son, I mean, they have 6 children, but Eitan was the, like I say, in every family, he was the, you know, the one who was going to become, and not just a Talmid Chacham, he was really, he was on the path to being a Gadol Yisrael, because he had a broad perspective. You know, you need to be a Gadol, it's not just how much you know. You have to have a perspective, and you have to have all time, and especially in our community, you know, in the religious Zionist, modern Orthodox community, you know, he had a secular, he had an academic approach. He combined academic learning and his proliferation at such a young age, and his insights and his is quite astounding. It's a real, real loss. I mean, of course, it's the terrible personal loss, but it's an unbelievable loss to Klal Yisrael.
Was it the loss of...
When he was killed. He was murdered in a terrorist attack on Chol HaMoed Sukkos 4 or 5 years ago.
Who was this we talking about? I'm seeing which
Eitan Henkin. He was the one who wrote the article that was put in by a mistaken student in like a put it into Rashi. That there's no way Rashi made. There's no way that Rabbi Meir hired somebody to seduce his wife. Like that's ridiculous, you know, type of thing. So it's printed in our Rashis. It is printed there. I can look it up again. It's a Avodah Zarah, if anybody wants to look it up. I think it's 18a in Masechet Avodah Zarah. I'll look it up right after the shiur.
Thank you. Look, this is another thing. Henkin, Leon Henkin, one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century.
Are you looking at him now? So somebody, just wrote to me, Louis Henkin was a university professor title, which meant he could teach in any faculty, any subject. A rare title. Yes, they're brilliant. These people are brilliant.
Leon Henkin, he was mathematical logic. He was one of the great figures with Kurt Gödel and others.
I know people like who knew him. I mean, he passed away, I don't know how many years ago. I mean, a while ago. But I mean, Rav Henkin, Sr., Eliyahu, Yosef Henkin passed away, I believe, in 1972, I believe. So, you know, not so long ago, Rav Moshe passed away in 1986. But those 14 intervening years, like America changed. It was a totally different America from a Jewish point of view from 1972 to 1986.
There's also, hi, this is Judy Sokolow. There's also musical talent there. There's a son named Daniel, Louis Henkin's son, who is a musician, teaches.
Okay.
And tremendous, you know, Balkore and Davin's Liyab and all that stuff. So
where does
there's
he
a lot
live?
Of talent in that family.
Yeah, of course. Where does this Henkin live? In America or in Israel?
No, the one I'm talking about, he teaches at Ramaz and he runs choir.
Oh, at Ramaz. So that's, is Louis Henkin's son?
I believe so. His father was a professor of history, right?
I don't know what he was a professor of. Yeah, yeah. So that. Not a young man. He's not a young man, I'm sure, by now.
He's not old either compared to me.
I understand. I mean, Rev Henkin, who passed away, that would be his brother, was 75. You know, could have a brother 10 years younger or whatever. I don't know. But
he was the cousin to the one who was killed.
Oh, he was he was a cousin or a nephew or an uncle.
I'm not sure. I think
okay,
I'm not
whatever.
Sure.
It's not important, but yes. Your point is well taken. Families, you know, listen, the Soloveitchik family, so you know his cousin who changed his name, who was not observant, was Soloway or something?
Yes, Robert Soloway.
Oops. President of Yale University.
So yes.
Soloveitchik's second cousin. What do you think? It's a coincidence. The Soloveitchik genes, you know, you marry and then you throw in the Lichtenstein genes, you know, yeah, that's... That's right.
I mean, I taught a kid once who was maybe one of the brightest 5 students I ever taught, who was a great nephew of the Rav, and he went on to be a lawyer. And he's whatever.
Right.
Yeah. But he's a lawyer in the public domain. He's not a.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. And listen, I don't
but
have to
tell you. He could have been. I don't know what, but that's not what.
Yeah, most. I think you know. I may have mentioned once. You know, Mark Shapiro once. You know, told me, and he's the expert in all these things. Mark said that every gadol at that time, like the generation, the end of the 19th century, in every single family, the majority, or at least some of the kids, became non-observant. In every Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, none of his siblings are from this day. Except the Soloveitchik family. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, they managed to keep their kids. From I think you know it depends. You go up another generation, of course, cousin now. But the Rav's siblings, his 4 siblings, are all observant. All remained observant. It's very unusual, even in families of Gadol Yisrael. It's one after another. Their kids became not, and we can't. It's just that was the time. That was the time, and there are all kinds of things. It's a much larger discussion. But certain families, so in the Soloveitchik family, even the ones who didn't remain observant, remained brilliant. You know, they didn't lose their brilliance; they just lost their observance. So, anyways, okay.
I believe
math and music are connected. Yeah, I'm not okay. Given a choice, people choose correct. Really? Yeah, there's a lot to discuss. I have a lot to say on that, but it's 10:45. So, I mean, I'm happy to stay on. I'm out to talk to people, but everybody.
My husband is teaching your daughter as we're talking here. It's your daughter?
Yes, my daughter. So last week, Atara calls us up and says, Moshe Sokolow, like she couldn't place it exactly. I said, yeah, he gives our Haftorah class. He said, oh, he's my teacher. I said, did you say hello? Like, said, not yet. She or she. So I said, okay, all this week, say hello. That's our daughter. Yeah, that's yeah, she's starting the Yoatzot Halakha program that Chana Henkin started.
Wow.
Please God. So she's in GPATS now. She's a Talmid HaChachamah, if I can say. I know I'm a biased father, but Baruch Hashem.
Yeah, but you know best because you're a biased father.
She's a Matzidah and a Talmid HaChachamah. Please God will make many contributions to Klal Yisrael, Bezrat Hashem, please God. So hopefully all my children.
And I wrote to you that that Sarah.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I apologize. I feel terrible. I started writing
Don't
back.
Don't feel terrible.
Sarah Hadassah. That's how we knew her. So I had to call up my sister. I haven't spoken to Sarah Hadassah in years. You know Suri Price. Then you must know Suri Price.
No.
Suri Silber. Maybe not. So that's my first cousin. Hadassah, like Sarah Hadassah, what you know, Cohen.
Right.
She's Kelly, correct. So she's my father's first cousin. But she's younger than my father. I was younger than my father. And I never really knew her well growing up because I had all my aunts and uncles living in New York. So we come to New York, I visit my aunts and uncles, my first cousin.
And not yet.
Sort of the next. But I know her at Surrey, my first cousin. My first cousin and Sarah and Kelly were very close. And she lives in Flatbush, you know, Surrey. And whatever. And that's okay. Yeah, it's a small world. And of course, Alan Simon.
She's a great lady.
Yes, yes. And I gave your regards already back to Alan Simon. I saw him last night.
Okay.
You know, it's a small, I don't know exactly the relationship. But when I mentioned your husband's name, he came over and he said, please give them my regards.
Simon. The this is Alan Simon.
Yeah, Alan Simon. Yeah.
Alan Simon and my husband were on Hatzalah together for a minute.
Okay,
for a very
he didn't say that.
And it was a very, you know, that can become a very intense relationship. And I think my husband kind of mentored him a little. He's younger. And he was at 9/11.
I know. So 2 years ago, he even asked me, because he's the president of our shul. You know,
right, that was hilarious when I heard
I give
that.
A lot of shiurim and stuff. So 2 years ago on Rosh Hashanah, it was September 11th. I think Rosh Hashanah was on September 11th. And he asked me, I said, if he should speak about his experiences between Mincha Mariv on Rosh Hashanah of 9/11. I said, absolutely, you should. And he spoke about the whole, you know, he was there when the building came down and he didn't know
if
he could survive. And it was quite a thing. He's saying it was quite, I think,
Hachayim
Bahamah.
It was quite traumatic. Correct. People don't realize.
Correct. What can be more appropriate for Rosh Hashanah? Mi'echiel mi'amut. And listen, I mean, it happened 6 days before Rosh Hashanah. I remember, you know, 9/11. I remember I was coming home to prepare my drushes. I was a pulpit rabbi in those days. And to prepare my my drushes for Rosh Hashanah, of course, I didn't do any preparation that day. You know, I was glued to the television.
Yeah.
Anybody else. But all right, what can we say? But anyway, okay. Okay, nice to
have a good
thank
Sabbath.
You. Thank you, Brother Garth.
Yeah,
love everybody. Sorry for keeping anybody longer than whatever, of course.
Okay. Thank you.
Be well. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Be well.
Okay.
All the best. Thank you. Thank you.